So our world is full of pain and suffering. Every day we read about new instances of really regrettable, horrible things, shootings, terrorist attacks, horrific car accidents, devastating natural disasters. In addition to events like these, they're all the hidden personal sufferings that don't make the national headlines. Countless people among our friends and family, as well as strangers unknown to us, quietly suffer afflictions such as depression, drug addiction, failed relationships, and rejections. So the obvious fact that our world includes much suffering of many different kinds has become the starting point of one of the oldest and most compelling arguments against the existence of God. So the argument known as the problem of evil goes as follows. And this is the first bullet point on your handout. I've labeled it the atheistic argument. So if there's a God, then there can be no evil. But there is evil, so therefore there can be no God. Now, why, you might ask, is the existence of God incompatible with evil? Well, if God is supposed to be all-knowing, as the traditional religions say, then God would be aware of all the evils happening in the world. For example, God would know about the terrorist plot before the attack happened. Furthermore, if God is all-powerful, God would be able to stop all evil. An omnipotent being like God could wipe out not only terrorists, but also ailments like childhood cancer. And finally, if God is supposed to be all good, as the religious people say, God would want to stop all the evils in our world. So you and I aren't infinitely good as God is supposed to be, but even we would want to end the suffering that we read about in the news every day, if only we were able. So if God is the sort of being who would know about all evil, be able to stop all evil, and want to stop all evil, then it should follow that if there were a God, all evil would have been eliminated in the world. But clearly there is evil in our world. So it seems that there cannot also be an all-knowing, all-powerful, and all-good God. So variations of this argument have been put forth by philosophers and theologians for centuries in an attempt to undermine belief in God. And religious believers have come up with their share of responses to this argument. So some religious believers see no tension between the existence of God and the presence of evil in our world because they see the suffering that befalls human beings as justly willed punishments for sin. So Pat Robertson, a former presidential candidate and prominent Christian televangelist, has expressed this view in the past. So a few years back on his TV show, The 700 Club, he said the following, and this quote is on your handout under the second bullet point. Every time the United States gets involved in some kind of pressure on Israel to split up their land, there's some natural disaster that happens here in America. If the United States pressures Israel to give up half of Jerusalem, God himself is going to come against this nation. Watch it. In Robertson's view, God has caused natural disasters to happen in the U.S. to punish us for our role in Middle East peace talks. From Robertson's perspective, there's no incompatibility between the existence of God and evil in this world. It doesn't follow from God's goodness that he wants to stop evil. Rather, God wills the particular evils we find in our world to punish people for their sins. Since God does not punish unjustly, we can surmise that people who suffer much must have sinned more greatly than those lives whose lives include less suffering. So in tonight's talk, what I want to do is I want to look at the great philosopher and theologian Thomas Aquinas for wisdom on the question of why there's evil in our world, given that the world as a whole is the creation of a good God. In particular, we'll look at what Aquinas has to say about the question of why God allows human beings to suffer, given that he particularly loves and cares for each individual human being. Aquinas rejects the atheistic conclusion that evil disproves God's existence. Aquinas thought that we could know with certainty that God exists. God is what explains why there's something rather than nothing. If we deny that God exists, we're left with no ultimate explanation for why the world around us is, rather than nothing at all. While Aquinas was firmly convicted of God's existence, he also rejected the view that all suffering is meted out by God as punishment for one's sins. In Aquinas' view, God doesn't meddle in nature to cause evils to happen, in particular places, to sinful people. Rather, he allows the creatures he made to act through their own powers, and this sometimes results in another creature suffering. In what follows, we'll see how Aquinas thought God's permission of his creatures' operations, through which they cause suffering to one another, was itself an expression of God's goodness and reconcilable with the particular love and care God has for each of his human creatures. So the first thing we need to consider to understand Aquinas' view is we have to think a little bit about what evil is and where it comes from. So this is going to be under the second number on your handout on the first page. So Aquinas' conception of what evil is, or rather what it's not, is strikingly different from how we in the modern world tend to think about evil. So we tend to identify evil with some sort of positive force that inclines humans toward acts of malice and inclines natural entities such as tornadoes toward destruction of human life or human property. By contrast, the majority of ancient and medieval thankers thought that evil was denied that evil was something positive. In their view, the term evil doesn't pick out some force or positive characteristic which all things we call evil have in common. Rather, what it means to say that something is evil or bad is that it's missing or lacking some good that it ought to have. And this definition of evil is on the handout under section 2. So blindness is a common example used to illustrate this point. Blindness is not some positive thing that gets added to a person. Rather, it's a lacking of sight. Let's consider another example. Consider bad cars. Think of all the ways in which a car can be bad. So bad can describe a car with failing brakes that skids instead of stops, or it can describe a car that has a failing carburetor that delays when it's supposed to accelerate. Or a bad car could be one whose body is just deteriorated from rust. So the term bad doesn't pick out a single list of positive features that all bad cars share in common. Rather, what it means to say that all those cars are bad is that they're missing or lacking some proper order or functioning that a car ought to have. Just as blindness is a lack of sight, sickness is a lack of health, badness in a car is a lack of proper functioning, so too all evils or bads, according to Aquinas, are really lacks of goods that should be present. So Aquinas maintained that even the evil or badness of sinful human actions was in itself a lacking or an absence of good. So suppose that Smith walks into a convenience store and steals a candy bar and then quickly runs away. When we break down the positive features of what Smith did, we have an act of walking, an act of grasping the candy, and then running. When we consider each of these elements by themselves, they're all good. You may have run in a really athletic or fast way, for example. Or you may have been really clever in how he plotted this act out. So there's nothing wrong by itself with grasping or running or with willing to experience the pleasure of eating a candy bar. So by themselves, all these things are good. What makes Smith's act bad or sinful is not one of the positive aspects of it, the running, the grabbing. What makes the act bad or evil is the fact that all these good elements were put together in a disordered way. They were combined together in a way that lacks order to the moral law. So the badness of sin is the lack of order that these things that are good in themselves is missing. So there's not some real positive element that gets added to the action to make it evil. The evil of the act just is a lacking of order. So to be clear, Aquinas doesn't think that evil is a fiction or an illusion. Rather, the point is that the things that we call evil, when we break them down, there are really a lot of good things which are just missing further goodness or further order that they're supposed to have. So you may now be wondering why this somewhat obscure point about evil being a lack of goodness, why does it matter for thinking about how God relates to evil or badness in the world? So Aquinas and his medieval counterparts thought that getting this point straight, that evil is a lacking rather than something positive, was of utmost importance for distancing God from causal responsibility for evil. So if evil is itself a positive reality, then it seems that it must have been brought into existence by God. If evil, if God is the creator of everything that exists and evil is something positive, then it's caused by God. The ancient Manichaeans tried to reject this conclusion by positing that, in addition to the good God, there was also an evil God that created all the bad and evil things. But there is another way to avoid the conclusion without giving up monotheism. So if evil's not something positive, then it can be the case both that one single good God is the creator of everything that exists, and God is not the creator of evil or badness. If evil's not something that actually is a being or an entity, it doesn't need God to bring it into existence. Everything real is made by God, and everything real, considered in itself, is good. So even if you're convinced up to this point, we can still ask the question, and this is the question stated under the definition of evil on the second part of the first page of the handout. So we can still ask this question: why is it that God would make creatures that can lose or lack goods that they ought to have? Why didn't God make people better, for example, such that they can't lose sight or they can't lose their health or be wounded? So wouldn't an omnipotent God make every one of his creatures so perfectly good that they can neither lose nor lack any goodness? So Aquinas thought it was really possible for God to make such excellent creatures. And he argued that a creation that includes creatures that can be diminished in their goodness and corrupted, as well as fail in their actions, is in fact really a better creation than one that only includes only the most perfect kinds of creatures. So Aquinas thinks that the reason why God created anything at all was to communicate his own goodness to creation and to have creatures represent his goodness. No one creature can by itself adequately represent the goodness of God because God's goodness is infinite. Every creature has only a finite, limited set of perfections. So by creating multiple diverse kinds of creatures, God's goodness is more perfectly reflected in creation, because what is lacking from one creature's perfections is contained and represented in another. So for instance, a beautiful sunset reveals something of God's grandeur that isn't manifested by a dog or a snail. But these living things show us something else about God's perfection that you don't see in the sunset or in the mountain range. So Aquinas' thought is that a world which contains all the multiple plethora kinds of things that we see in our world is actually a better world than a world that was populated by only angels, for example, by only the very highest, best kind of creatures. Even the lowest kinds of creatures that can fail and corrupt, they show us something about God. So Aquinas thought that diversity of kinds of creatures implies that there's going to be things that are more or less good than one another. So what makes one kind of creature different from another kind of creature is a difference in what perfections they have. And so one species is going to be sort of lacking something that another has. And even these less perfect ones contribute to God's goodness. And he thought that these creatures that can lose goodness and fail in their actions are one of the kinds that contribute to manifesting God's goodness in the world. So Aquinas offers some further thought. So all that just explains why is it God made creatures that can suffer and fail and be weakened and lose goodness. So Aquinas offers some other thoughts about why it is in the actual world that at a given time or place, a creature which can lose its goodness actually does lose its goodness. And so to understand what Aquinas' thought is and what are the actual causes that make something lose some of its goodness, we have to distinguish more clearly between two kinds of evils. So if you turn to page 2 of the handout, in those boxes on the top of page 2, I've broken down the two kinds of evils he talks about. So first, there are evils that are a lack of good or perfection that ought to belong to a being, given the kind of thing it is. Examples of these kinds of evils are things like blindness in the human being, a loss of life that a lamb suffers when a lion eats it. So let's call these evils suffered. The second sort of evil is a failure in a being's action. So these evils include things like a seed's failing to sprout, an animal's walking with a limp, and a human being committing sinful actions. So let's call these evils done. So according to Aquinas, evils that are suffered by one creature are caused by another creature seeking its own perfection. So he often gives an example of a fire. So for a fire to burn and grow, air has to be corrupted and destroyed. The good of one creature often requires the destruction of another. For a lion to preserve its life, it has to destroy things like lambs and eat them. So the fact that some creatures can and in fact are being be destroyed, it actually contributes to the order and the perfection of the universe as a whole. So is the death of the lamb good for the lamb? Of course not. But Aquinas thinks its destruction is in fact a good for the lion. Through that destruction, the lion's life is preserved, and it's a good for the universe as a whole, because without the destruction of the lamb, we don't have this creature, the lion, that somehow is representing and manifesting God's goodness in our creation. So Aquinas acknowledges that in a way you can even say that God indirectly wills evil suffered, because he wills the good of the whole. He wills there to be lions, and he wills for them to be nourished. So as a consequence, God sort of indirectly wills that some members of other species are going to be destroyed so that lions can be part of his creation. So now let's turn to see what the cause is for why creatures sometimes fail in their actions. So why is it that animals limp or seeds fail to sprout? Why does that happen? So Aquinas thinks the reason that creatures fail in their actions is because they're missing some good or perfection within themselves. So the lion limps because of the wound in its leg. In the case of human sins, we sin not because some other creature has caused a defect in us. So the lamb limps because the lion wounded its leg. So the lion sort of causes that defect in the lamb that then causes it to act in a defective way. But when we choose wrongly, when we sin, Aquinas thinks we actually cause the defect in ourselves that leads to our sinning. So according to Aquinas, we freely sort of put our will in a defective state. When we fail, we don't do something we ought to do, and precisely what we fail in is considering the moral law. So it's not by sort of doing something we make our will corrupted. It's by doing something, by not doing something. So again, it's an absence or a lacking. So when we act in a moral matter without having considered the moral law and subjected our will to it, then a defective action follows from our will. So Aquinas thinks that God gives creatures the power by whereby they act, and he cooperates with them in bringing their actions into existence. But God always acts perfectly. He never fails. And the reason why there's a defect in the creature's action is because the creature had a prior defect in it that leads it to cooperate in a defective way with bringing its action into existence. So God doesn't cause or bring into being the defective actions of creatures. He does everything he should to make those actions turn out well, but then the creature, when it cooperates with God, sort of fails in it in providing its cooperation and help to get that action into being. So far we've seen Aquinas' view on what evil is and where it comes from. So we've seen that evil, according to Aquinas, is a lack of good that a creature ought to have, or a failure in the creature's action. We've also seen Aquinas' thoughts on why there are beings which can lose their goodness. They contribute to the overall goodness of the universe as a whole. And so we just saw that Aquinas thinks what he thinks sort of the actual causes are for why goodness is lacking in creatures or in their actions. So the important point to realize from all this is that God doesn't directly cause evil. It's not something he creates. And it's not, he doesn't cause creatures to mess up or fail in their actions. What God causes is several different kinds of good creatures, and he gives them the power to perform actions that promote their own good. So as we've seen, sometimes what's good for one creature, like the lion, and what's good for the universe as a whole, may entail a loss of good for another creature. So now we turn to the question of how does all this fit with God's providence or his loving care for each type of creature and each individual human being in particular. So the picture we've seen so far of Aquinas' views can lead us to wonder, does Aquinas care about the flourishing of individual creatures? Or sorry, does God care about the flourishing of individual creatures? So if God wills for the universe as a whole to more perfectly represent his goodness, and this in turn requires for some creatures to suffer evil, it might seem that God's willing the good of the whole is at odds with his willing the good of each individual creature. So how can God's making a universe in which there are lions, for example, fit with his willing that Bambi the deer flourish? Or for an even more difficult question, how can God's allowing certain human beings to use their freedom to commit atrocities fit with his loving care for the individuals who suffer these atrocities? So let us consider how Aquinas approaches these very challenging questions. So according to Aquinas, God doesn't just create a bunch of creatures and then leave them to their own devices to work out how the history of the world unfolds. So Aquinas thinks that God governs the world through his providence. This means that details about the world, such as how many individual creatures there are, when they come into and go out of existence, and what actions they do and in what order, are established by God's wisdom. So God's providence over the world doesn't eliminate genuine agency in creatures and freedom in humans. God's providence works through creaturely causes and even creaturely human freedom. The goal that God aims for in establishing the order of creation is his own goodness again. He wants to best communicate his goodness to creation. So he's trying to create a world. He's trying to order it in a certain way that it's going to best reflect his goodness. So creatures like us with intellects are able to fulfill that general goal of creation as a communication of God's goodness in a special way because we can actually know and love God. We can actually, with our intellects, be united, think about God, and so have that representation of God in us in a very special way. And we can be eternally united with God, because on Aquinas' view, humans are immortal. So everything which exists in the universe and everything that happens is arranged by God for the sake of intellectual creatures, in Aquinas' view, reaching this eternal goal of union with God. So Aquinas goes so far to say that all the other creatures that God has made in the material universe exist for the sake of humans reaching their final goal. Not only do plants, trees, and animals in the obvious way allow us to sustain our bodies by providing food, clothing, and shelter, they're also, and for Aquinas I think this is even more important, they're instruments by which we know God. So by seeing all of these creatures he's made, we know something of God. We sort of are able to be intellectually united with God. And so Aquinas thinks that other material creatures, they fulfill their higher purpose most fully when we contemplate them and know God through them. So the fact that non-intellectual creatures, by non-intellectual creatures, I mean things like dogs, grass, trees, mountains, so anything basically that's not a human being or an angel, things that can't think and know God. Aquinas thinks these things all exist for the sake of, so his thought that all of these things exist for the sake of contributing to humans being united with God impacts how God regards these other creatures in his providence, in his ordering of creation. So no particular individual of another species is necessary for a human being to flourish. So think about it. Your body can be nourished by a hamburger made by any old cow. It doesn't have to be Bessie the cow in particular for you to be nourished. Some other cow can come along. You can eat that one. And you don't depend particularly on any exact mountain range, for example, to contemplate God's grandeur. One mountain range could be wiped out and replaced with another one. So these other things, the goods that they create, contribute to creation, they're easily replaceable by other things of their kind. So since none of the creatures, other creatures, non-human ones in particular, are necessary for the goods of the universe as a whole, Aquinas thinks that in God's providence, he's not ordering the things that happen in the universe for the sake of preserving any particular non-intellectual creature. So God hasn't ordered the universe toward the good of Bambi the deer or Cecil the lion. other lions or deers that will replace them can contribute the same goods that they contribute to the universe as a whole. So although God isn't concerned with sort of ordering everything to preserve one particular non-intellectual creature in existence, Aquinas thinks that God governs the universe in such a way that it works for the good of different animal species. So, for example, he orders the universe that each species has a suitable kind of food, that he creates suitable food for it and suitable shelter. And God, in Aquinas' view, is also responsible for giving non-intellectual creatures the very internal instincts they have by which they perform actions that promote their good. So God is responsible for birds having this sort of sense of how to build nests in a way that preserves them from the elements. They don't have minds. They can't think all that through, but God's implanted in them this instinct on how to act for their benefit. So God is sort of working to preserve the species as a whole, that some member of the species will continue on, but not any given particular one. But let's turn now to see how God, how a God's providence works with human beings. So Aquinas thought that God's providence relates to humans in a very special way. So God doesn't order the world merely so that the human species has what it needs to continue on. It's very different when it comes to human beings. God's providence seeks to bring each individual human to their final goal of an eternal and loving, knowing union with God, in Aquinas' view. So the good things that God gives to human beings in his providence, they're not for the sake of some higher creature. So God makes sure that the lion can flourish so that we can know God through the lion, or so that, you know, some other being might have suitable food that might, rely on to the lamb. He wants the lamb to be so the lion can have it for food. But he doesn't want good things for us just for the sake of some other creature to sort of make use of the goods we have. So by our deaths, for example, we don't provide food to sustain some other animal as the lamb does for the lion. The goods that God gives to humans are for the benefit of the individual humans themselves. So your bodily health from God and your moral virtues, for example, they're for the sake of you only, not for something else in the other, in the universe to be made better through these goods that you have. So we can ask the question then, why does God allow humans to suffer and die if there's no higher species which needs to make use of humans for themselves? So why doesn't God prevent individual humans from suffering evils if human suffering isn't necessary for the universe as a whole to flourish? So God doesn't prevent Bambi from suffering because by Bambi suffering, some other being in the universe flourishes. But our suffering and death doesn't lead to some other kind of creature flourishing. In Aquinas' view, it wasn't in fact God's initial will that humans should suffer bodily death and corruption. According to Christian theology, God created the first human beings in a state called original justice. So God gave the first humans, Adam and Eve, in Aquinas' view, special gifts that human beings don't naturally have. Through a special gift, the first humans' intellects had perfect command over their behavior, and they possessed every moral virtue. So sometimes for us, we're presented with a chocolate cake during Lent, for example, and we know, oh, I shouldn't do this, but we still have that desire for it, and sometimes we give in and do it. But in the state of original justice, as soon as a human would have that thought, oh, I know this isn't good, I shouldn't do it, the rest of their body and their passions sort of obeyed and worked with their intellect. So this was a very good state for human beings. Their souls were very powerful in that state. And Aquinas very interestingly thought that the soul of a human was so powerful that it was able to prevent the body that the soul enlivened from suffering corruption and death. So in Aquinas' view, the soul is very closely linked to the body. He calls the soul the form of the body, what makes the body to be what it is. And so when our souls were in this very powerful state through God's special gifts to it, the soul held the body together in such a way that it just didn't fall apart as material objects normally do. But so we all know how the story goes. Adam and Eve chose sin and they rejected God's rule. So with this, they also rejected the special gifts they'd been given by God. So we all have had situations where a friendship ends. So would it be appropriate if a friendship is broken off to keep, you know, going over to your friend's house and offering to give them a ride or inviting them to do things and giving them things? No, we wouldn't be respecting their freedom if they had chosen to end the relationship. So God respects human beings and their decision to sort of have this separation with God, and he withdraws the special things he's given to humans. And then our bodies go back into sort of that natural state where they corrupt and decay and break down. So in response to your original sin, God wills for us to have these consequences of bodily death and the suffering that the decay of our bodies involves. So, but of course, this isn't the whole story. God also wills to send Christ into the world with the plan of reconciling human beings to himself. But the important point to take away is that the evil suffered by humans isn't something that God sort of indirectly wills, like the death of the lamb, for the sake of the good of the universe as a whole. Rather, our physical death and suffering is a consequence that God allowed to follow from our first parents' rejection of the gifts God originally gave our race. But there's still more we can ask here. So bodily death and corruption, they're not the only sorts of evils human beings suffer in the world. It would be nice if that was all we had to contend with just getting old and dying a natural death. Obviously, that's hard, but we know that there's so much more. Sensible acts of violence, horrible car accidents, abuse, neglect. So it seems that God could have just allowed our bodies to break down and die as a consequence of original sin, while still sort of using his providence to order the universe such that no children would starve, for instance, or no acts of terror were committed. So why doesn't God providentially order the universe to save us from all of this other additional evil we experience beyond bodily death and corruption? So Aquinas addresses a question like this most poignantly in his biblical commentary on the book of Job. So for those who are unfamiliar with the story, Job was a just man who was always careful to avoid doing evil. He was very wealthy and had a large family. In the story, Satan appears before God and claims that Job has only lived an upright life because he has been blessed with so much and has faced so little adversity. So Satan thinks that if Job were to experience some real trials, he would no longer be faithful to God. So God permits Satan to test Job's virtue. In the course of the story, Job's livestock, servants, and children are all killed in quick succession. And that's not it. Then Job himself is afflicted with a very painful, embarrassing illness. And his friends also in the story, they see this happening and they say, well, Job, surely you've done something wrong, and this must be why this is happening to you. So just repent of your sin and, you know, get God to stop punishing you. So his friends hold the view, which we heard from Robertson at the beginning of the talk, that evil is a punishment for sin. So throughout the story, Job maintains his innocence, and he's eventually vindicated. So Aquinas' commentary on this book of the Bible provides an opportunity for him to reflect upon the question of what are the reasons or causes for why God permits innocent people to suffer. So remember from the beginning, God doesn't cause goods to be taken away from people. He doesn't cause directly our bodies to corrupt, or he doesn't sort of cause natural disasters to befall us. He just permits the natural causes to act according to their natures. But he couldn't intervene and stop it. He could sort of zap the tornado when it's about to hit and destroy a village. So why does he permit suffering? Why doesn't he intervene to stop it? So Aquinas writes in his commentary on Job, and this is the first text in the middle of page 2. So one thing which seems most severe is that the innocent experience of many adversities in this life, besides the death which is common to all. It seems reasonable that the innocent, who are not guilty of their own sins, should not be inflicted with any other punishments besides the death which is due to original sin. So from various passages from throughout Aquinas' commentary on Job, and some from other works, we can try to piece together his response to this question he's formulated of why God allows or permits innocent people to suffer evils beyond bodily death and corruption. Aquinas' basic thesis is that God allows people to suffer because he can work an even greater good out of their suffering. So Aquinas also often repeats the following quote, which he gets from Augustine. And this is text 2 on your handout. Quote, Almighty God would nowise permit evil to exist in his works unless he were so almighty and so good as to produce good even from evil, end quote. So the greater good that God works from human suffering, it's not going to be good for the universe as a whole or for some higher other different creature in the universe. Rather, Aquinas' thesis is that the greater good of humans that comes from human suffering is a good for human beings themselves. So in order to understand what sort of greater goods Aquinas has in mind that come from suffering, we have to remember how Aquinas sees the goal of human life. So in our modern society, we tend to think that the goal of human living is getting us those things that'll bring us pleasure and honor in this world. Delicious food, good entertainment, a prestigious job, a nice house, a beautiful spouse, and perhaps 2.5 successful, well-behaved children. That's how we tend to conceive of the good life in our day and age. You can add in some more things. So now Aquinas doesn't deny that these things are in fact good. They're good. But in his view, these goods are neither necessary nor sufficient for achieving the true purpose for which we exist. So even with those worldly goods, our hearts are always going to desire something more. Aquinas thinks that the true satisfaction of our desires, that is our true happiness, lies in achieving a union with God in the next life. In order to reach this goal, though, we have to be transformed into the sort of people who will freely love God. According to Aquinas, God at times permits suffering and trials to happen to a person because he knows that through these trials, a person will grow in the virtues that enable them to be more fully united to God in the next life. So I'm going to read you another passage from Aquinas. This is on page 3, text number 3. So Aquinas writes in his commentary on Job, Now it happens that God sometimes permits trials or even some spiritual defects to happen to some to obtain their salvation. As Romans says, quote, all things work together for good for those who love God. In this way, God comes to man to obtain his salvation, and yet man does not see him because he cannot perceive his kindness, end quote. So notice the last line of this quote. Aquinas points out that oftentimes we can't see that good is happening to us through our trials. So I'm going to skip reading this next long quote, text 4, but you can look at it on your own. I mean, Mary says that, you know, sometimes we ask God in the midst of a trial, take this suffering away from me, take this trial away. And Aquinas makes an analogy to a physician. Imagine if you had a disease and a doctor said, you need to take this medicine or have this treatment. If it's a bitter medicine or a painful treatment, we might say, no, take this away. But does a good doctor take it away? No, his goal isn't to make you sort of experience pleasure and be comfortable in the moment. It's to affect your final curing, your final healing. And Aquinas's thought is that this is what suffering does to the human character, that God permits suffering because it can transform us into the sort of people who are going to reach that final union. So Aquinas doesn't, he's not committed to the view that we can sort of, you know, look at individual instances of suffering and see exactly what good is being worked from them. Oftentimes that's a mystery, even to the person who's suffering, what good God is doing through it. But Aquinas thinks at a more general level, we can kind of see these correlations. So he says, by being treated with animosity, you can grow in benevolence. By being put into situations where we're tested and tried, we develop patience. We can develop through experiencing our weaknesses. We can grow in humility. I want to briefly mention just a modern day example of someone who personally believes in this sort of view expressed by Aquinas. So Joni Erickson Tada is the founder and CEO of an organization called Joni and Friends, which provides support to people living with disabilities. When she was 17, she suffered a diving accident that left her paralyzed and also without the use of her hands. It's kind of cool. She has learned to paint. She puts a paintbrush in her mouth and paints all these really cool things. So she wrote a book called When God Weeps, and here's a quote from it. Quote, before my paralysis, my hands reached for a lot of the wrong things, and my feet took me into some bad places. After my paralysis, tempting choices were scaled down considerably. My diving accident was the beginning of a long, arduous process of becoming like Christ, end quote. She goes on to write, quote, hardships have forced me to make decisions about God. Suffering has done a job on my character. I'm not so sloppy about relationships. I stick to promises. I'm more patient. People matter more, end quote. So no one likes to suffer, but there are a lot of people with similar stories like Joni who can see sort of themselves being transformed through that suffering. So we might wonder, well, why is it that suffering has this unique power to transform us into better versions of ourselves? In his book on God and the World, Pope Benedict XVI describes suffering as the inner side of love. So he writes, quote, anyone who really wanted to get rid of suffering would have to get rid of love before anything else. There can be no love without suffering because love always demands an element of self-sacrifice. Because given temperamental differences and the drama of situations, love will always bring with it renunciation and pain, end quote. In learning how to inwardly embrace suffering, we become more capable of setting ourselves aside for others, which is the essence of love. So in Pope Benedict's words, quote, it's so important to learn how to suffer, end quote. To learn how to suffer is to learn how to love. So it seems that for Aquinas, the goods that come from suffering, they don't always go to the one who undergoes suffering. So it's not, Aquinas isn't committed to the view that every case of suffering is permitted by God so the one who suffers can be having this character transformation. He actually says in the commentary, sometimes there are other goods that come too. So he says in the commentary on Job that sometimes innocent people are permitted to suffer because the way in which they respond to their suffering serves as an example to inspire others. So Aquinas believes that Scripture reveals that Job himself was permitted to suffer so much to leave this model for us on how to bear suffering with patience. So one might wonder, is this really just for God to allow someone like Job to lose their kids, to lose their livestock, to be sort of, you know, endure this public shame from their illness and people assuming he must be a sinner? Is this just for God to let him endure all that just for the sake of all of us later people having this example? Has he done Job an injustice? So Aquinas says some really interesting things about this in his commentary on Job. Aquinas says that since our temporal blessings are gratuitous gifts from God, we have no just complaint if God gives them to us only for a time and not for the entirety of our life. So in text 5, he says, quote, man does not have a just complaint with God if he should be despoiled of his temporal goods, because he who gave freely could bestow them either until the end of his life or temporarily. So when he takes the temporal goods away from man before the end of life, man can't complain. So Aquinas's point is that these goods we have, they weren't owed to us. They're not necessary for even reaching our final good, like gratuitous gifts from God. Now, Aquinas thinks it's okay to be sad if one of your family members dies or your house burns in a fire, for example. He reminds us that even in the commentary that even Christ, according to Scripture, felt sadness. It's in our nature to feel sadness when we lose a good, or to feel joy when we receive a good. But his point is that on the intellectual level, for just thinking intellectually, is this just or fair? His answer is yes, because these things aren't owed to us by God. But he also emphasizes that God will never permit a good that is actually necessary for a person's salvation to be taken away from them. He writes, quote, from the day of his birth, you help him by your providence with the things necessary for his life and glorification, whether they are corporeal or spiritual. So every bodily need we have, or every sort of spiritual need, Aquinas thinks God is going to make sure in his providence we have those. But if God sees it's not necessary for our salvation, he might permit it for the sake to be taken away for the sake of a greater good. So I'm almost done, but I want to mention just a few critical questions we can ask about Aquinas's view. And these are listed on the back side of the handout. There's a couple quotes I skipped over in the interest of time that you may won't be interested in looking at later on that penultimate page. So one question you might have. So First, you might wonder whether we should remain passive in the face of evil that others suffer. So should you help your neighbor pick up the stack of books they dropped in the hallway? Or should you just walk on by? Because after all, maybe this humiliation is being permitted by God to work for her salvation. So it's an interesting question. If all suffering is permitted by God for the sake of a greater good, should we just stand back passive so we're not depriving people from opportunities of receiving greater goods? So Aquinas doesn't directly address it, but here's a few thoughts about it. So first of all, obviously, we need to remember the commands that God has given us to alleviate the sufferings of our neighbors. So although evil can work for good, evil is still not of itself good for a human being. Our aid to our neighbor might be the very means God wants to use to prevent an evil that he knows will not work for someone's good. So if God wants to permit an evil and we try to stop it, our efforts won't be successful. God will sort of, in his providence, make sure that we don't stop things that he sees are working good. But we can't presume to know the complicated relationships that obtain between events in this world and the spiritual states of human souls. Thus, we need to, above all, follow God's commandments to aid our neighbors in need and let God sort out for himself how the events in the world, including suffering, work for the good of human salvation. So another question one might ask about Aquinas' claim that God permits suffering for the sake of a greater good is whether it's empirically plausible. So that means, does it really fit with our experience, what we see in the world? So we see too many examples in the world of people who don't seem to grow stronger through their suffering. Rather, they're broken by evil they experience, and they turn their backs on God. So far as I know, Aquinas doesn't directly address these cases either, but he does claim that if a person was truly just, God would never permit anything to happen which would impede their final salvation. He writes, quote, "God, however, extends his providence over the just in a certain more excellent way than over the wicked, inasmuch as he prevents anything happening which would impede their final salvation. For to them who love God, all things work together unto good," end quote. So it seems that there are two possibilities for the case of people who appear to turn away from God in the face of great suffering. So if we accept Aquinas' claim that God would never permit a suffering that impedes someone's salvation, so what could be possibly going on in those cases? So first, it could have been the case that the person wasn't turned to God in the first place. Thus, their suffering didn't, in fact, turn them away from God because they weren't sort of turned to God even prior to the suffering. The second possibility is that despite appearances that their suffering somehow did draw them closer to God in a way that we can't see or know. As outsiders, we're not in a position to judge sort of how things are working for someone's salvation. I'm going to skip the next question, but we can talk about it in the Q&A if people want to talk about that one. So now that we've considered Aquinas' own views on why God permits evil to happen, let's see what Aquinas has to say about the views, like we saw at the beginning, and like Job's friends, who think that all evils that befall a human being are punishment for sin. So in Aquinas' view, God doesn't strike down wicked people with natural disasters and make them suffer illnesses in payment for their sins. And he gives two reasons for why God doesn't operate like this. First, the unjust wouldn't recognize that bad things which happen to them are in fact punishments. So if an unjust man suffers a loss of his fortune in the stock market, for example, do you think he's going to say, oh, well, this must be a divine punishment for my sin and then be converted by it? No, he's going to grumble that what he thinks he rightly deserved has been taken away. So unjust people just aren't even in a condition to see, sort of view things that bad things that happen to them and recognize them as punishments. So God doesn't see this as being an effective way as correcting them. So second, Aquinas claims that temporal suffering and the loss of worldly prosperity aren't even adequate punishments for sin. So sin is a turning of one's back on God. Taking away someone's goods, their fortune, their health, that's not an adequate sort of punishment for turning one's back on God. Sort of what sort of fits as a consequence for that is the loss of God in the next life. So Aquinas says those who expect temporal prosperity as a reward for virtue and temporal suffering as punishment for vice, they're just simply mistaken about the horizon of human existence, what we truly exist for and what our true goal is. So we don't exist for the sake of living lives of pleasure, comfort, and ease. Rather, God made us for eternal union with himself. And Aquinas claims, therefore, that God's goodness and wisdom is manifest by, quote, the fact that spiritual goods are given to the just as better goods, and temporal goods are given to the wicked as transitory, end quote. So what he's saying is that the just people receive better goods through their suffering than the worldly goods that and the pleasures that belong to the wicked. So I'd like to end, well, just summarize, or I'll end with just one final point from Aquinas. In this talk, we've focused on intellectual questions a person can raise about God and evil. So besides the theoretical questions we can ask about evil and why God allows it, there's, of course, the real palpable distress that people feel when they suffer. Aquinas thought that while God doesn't intervene to stop evil from occurring, he nevertheless is not a passive bystander in the face of his creature's suffering. In fact, Aquinas thought that God draws even nearer to those who suffer to provide them with the inner consolation they need to face their suffering. So he writes, and this is text 8 on the last page, quote, people need to be supported in the face of evils which occur, and that is to receive comfort, because unless a man had something in which his heart could rest, he would not stand firm when evils came upon him. Therefore, a person comforts another by affording him something refreshing in which he can rest in evil times. And although a man might be comforted by something and find rest and be supported in it in the case of some evils, it is God alone who comforts us in all evils. Hence, Paul says, the God of all comfort, end quote. For good reasons, Aquinas' God doesn't intervene in creation to keep his creatures free of all suffering. That would be to deprive us of the goods we can gain through suffering. Yet, as this quote reveals, God is neither an unmoved spectator passively watching those who suffer great pain. God himself draws near to the hearts of those who are struggling to comfort them in their afflictions. God never abandons his suffering creatures in Aquinas' view. Thank you. Do we still have time for questions?
Or? We do.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay, great.
I think if you just want to call on people, as you will.
Yeah, what's your name?
Austin.
Austin, thank you.
About the second bullet point on the bottom of the first page, I was just curious, because you were talking about why doesn't God make X amount ad infinitum number of angels? So it seems, on the one hand, that it's metaphysically possible for God to make whatever amount of angels or more perfect beings, but it's also possible for God to make whatever amount of lesser creatures of lesser perfection. So one question I have about this is about whether there's any sort of level of arbitrariness according to Aquinas about this. So
yeah,
in God's choice. Why can't it be here? What would Aquinas say about why can't God create some sort of optimal level of creatures who are rational or more perfect, while at the same time making some sort of optimal level of lesser creatures that best express his goodness? And to quickly clarify this a little bit more, so it seems there's two levels at play going on here. So on the one hand, in answering the question about what God chooses to create, we don't want to say that God doesn't consider the perfection of beings when he actualizes them from possibility, for otherwise God would be acting capriciously
yeah.
or without a sufficient reason. On the other hand, we don't want to say that God acts without some specific moral ends for the best in expressing his goodness, and rational creatures, say, coming to realize said ends and having the means of realizing and acting for their salvation. And so, is there a sense in which Aquinas might say that God somehow antecedently wills the good and consequently the best?
So this is a great question. So really, I think what your question is getting at is the question of, is there like one best possible world with like the optimal number of every kind of creature and like the optimal sort of state of events and how they unfold? Because if you say that the alternative would be, no, there is no best possible world, there's just, you know, a lot of worlds that, you know, they could be equally good as each other, and sort of a worry you might have is that, well, then how does God choose between them? There's going to be some arbitrariness. He just flips a coin, or I don't know, decides what he feels like. And so this question has been important in the history of philosophy, and there's been a lot of theological debate between medieval thinkers and especially in the early modern period with Leibniz. So Aquinas' view is that there is no best possible world. And the reason for that is because remember Aquinas is saying that the world, the purpose of it is to reflect God's goodness, and God's goodness is infinite. So there's never going to be a world that reflects all the infinite goodness. There could always be a better one, a better world. But he does think that, as we've seen, worlds which contain more kinds of creatures are going to be better than worlds that contain just, you know, a limited set of kinds of creatures. So he thinks you can sort of like maybe rank groups of worlds, but that there's not going to be like a best in each of those sets that God would have to choose. So then we have the question, well, is it going to be arbitrary, the choice? But we got to remember, too, that God is also working. Providence works through human freedom. So I think it's not going to depend entirely on God, but also humans and secondary causes are also sort of working with God to bring things into existence. And so you could say maybe that gets around the arbitrariness problem. Because, for example, it's not arbitrary that God chose to create this world with me talking now, because I was part of sort of like bringing this world into existence as well. And so I sort of chose it. And with the thinking about free will, I mean, if you hold a certain view of free will that our intellects aren't determined by what we judge best, you're going to have that problem with any free decision. That if you could have good reasons and still choose the opposite of your reasons, you know, there's not going to be a sufficient reason that's going to entail, you know, any choice. It's not like specifically a problem for God. I'm sorry, did that answer kind of what you were
saying?
Yeah,
it just gets into further.
Yeah, sorry.
That are
said, yeah.
Absolutely bound with this.
Yeah, it's a few other questions.
What would Thomas say to the question, is anyone ever given suffering they can't handle?
Yeah.
So there's a saying, God will never give you anything that you can't handle. And I've actually said that before, and someone who disagreed with that statement strongly. I think this person actually helped their father, you know, commit suicide, assisted suicide. And he said something like, you obviously have never been into a, you know, some sort of wing of a nursing home where people are very, you know, senile and dementia. And so what is the answer to that?
So, in one of the quotes towards the end, there's a passage where he says that in the case of the just, God is not going to ever permit a suffering to happen to them that's going to turn them away from their final salvation. Mm. So like that quote, we all probably have said it or heard it, God never gives you anything you can't handle. I mean, the term, what does it mean to handle something, can be said in mean many different things. So is God going to allow people to experience suffering that to them it feels like it's destroying them? I think yes. Aquinas would say yes. I mean, God can allow people to feel suffering, to suffer in ways that they feel they can't bear it. But he also is saying that although you feel that way, you can feel that way, that in the case of the just, the people who are going to be saved, he's never going to permit them suffering that is going to thwart their salvation. But, I mean, it gets really complicated because it seems that I'm not an expert in these areas of, you know, predestination and reprobation. And, I mean, it seems Aquinas thinks that there are also people who are not the just, and God may permit sufferings to them that through their free will they do handle it poorly, and it may be sort of their choices in that those suffering situations do contribute to their not being saved. So it's a complicated question because it depends on what we mean by handle and sort of what groups of people we're talking about. It's a good question. Any other? Yeah.
So I sort of had a follow-up on Austin's question. So I feel like I get the Aquinas view about goodness and badness, that it's all sort of end relative or nature relative in some sense. And so it makes sense of why, you know, you can figure out what's good for a car based on a car nature or humans and so forth. But then he also talks about better and worse worlds. And when you talk about worlds, at least in analytic philosophy, it's like just a, you know, maximally consistent proposition. And so it doesn't really have a nature such that you could think, oh, yes, that's a better and worse world. And then the same thing goes with, like, creatures. When he talks about some creatures are more perfect than others, I'm thinking creature itself doesn't have some sort of telos such that humans... So I've raised this question to some people who read Aquinas more than me, and they said that they think he means something like more perfect or less perfect with respect to resembling God's nature or something like that. So that helps out with clarifying what he means when he talks about more or less perfect creatures. What about the more or less perfect world, or better or worse? That's one thing, because I wasn't going to ask that, but I thought to follow up what Austin said. And then the other thing is, when you're talking about the two causes of all the evils in the world, so one of the types of evils is where creatures suffer, and you said that one of the causes of it is one creature acting for its own perfection, and that might harm another creature. But when you think about, like, tornadoes, I wouldn't naturally think the tornado is acting for its own perfection. In fact, I thought on Aquinas' view, what was definitive about living things is that they were the only things that acted for their own perfection. But I wouldn't think you would think tornadoes are alive or a boulder falling on some animal. So I'm not exactly sure how that... Does he really think that those tornadoes and stuff are acting for their own perfection? So.
Yeah, good. So those are two great questions, and they're similar in a way, actually. So with the first question, you're asking, so for a world, how can we judge what is a better or worse world if a world doesn't have a nature and a telos? So for Aquinas, God's purpose in creation is to manifest his own goodness. So the world as a whole, so in analytic philosophy, possible world through those sets of propositions. So world in this set, in this sense, it's the actual created substances. You could talk of them as being the world. So just, you know, it's not anything over and above all the created substances, but just that group. That group as a whole can sort of be a better or worse manifestation of God. And sort of in saying the ones that sort of include more diversity in them are better manifestations. The standard is going to be God's own goodness again. And things you could talk about that being, can be talking about, there's nothing over and above, and talking about being the world, because there are sort of these orders and causal activities that they exercise in each other. So you could talk about being like a unified manifestation of God. And then with the second question, that's a good one about tornadoes and boulder fallen. And I think with any natural phenomenon, like a tornado, so it's not going to have its own telos, but and you could break down like all the different sort of maybe micro level phenomena that are causing a natural disaster, and each one of those micro phenomena are going to be, you know, Aquinas is something acting towards its own perfection. And even so, it's kind of in his view of sort of like heavy. He thinks like a heavy object does this sort of this nature to fall, and the fires and like nature to rise, being light. So it's, I mean, there's a little bit of different science going on there. Like, he thinks all kind of, like, even locomotion is sort of an teleological expression of nature. So, yeah, I think he just would talk about break down the natural phenomena into the micro phenomena, and those are going to be instances of things expressing their natures at the level of perfection. Great questions.
I just want to add something, because that was a really great answer. I was thinking, isn't it true to say that for Aquinas, like, the perfection of the world doesn't only consist in the perfection of the extent to which each creature participates in the divine perfection or manifests the divine goodness, but also in the way in which each creature is ordered with respect to the other creatures. So it's like not only the individual, each individual perfection, but it's their ordering also to each other. Is a reflection of the ordering of all things in the plan of providence in God's mind.
Yeah, because he talks about how the goal of providence, so like you could raise almost like the same kind of question Austin said, well, is it arbitrary? Why does God choose one ordering of all the substances versus another? Like, how does he choose between these two different plans? And is it just random and arbitrary? And I think, like, kind of your point applies there to that, that he thinks, like, it's not just the substances themselves, but, the ordering also is reflecting God's goodness. So some orders might be better because, you know, more rational creatures, like, are saved in those orders.
And that order, like, includes, like, the pattern of created causality. I mean, that's what causality is. So
yeah, the free actions that people perform in the order. Thank you. Other questions? I just had a smile. I was like, you've got something you want to ask, I think.
I guess I'll ask one more. So when you said all the non-humans, their purpose was for humans, did you mean like that's actually their telos, or that just that God created them for that purpose?
Yeah, so they have their own telos. Like, I mean, there's some standard, you know, what is it to be a good frog, for example, and a frog can fail, you know, to be a good frog, it's not a good jumper or good at catching flies. So there's like an objective standard given by the nature of each creature. And so they have like their intrinsic telos, but then they also have like sort of this secondary purpose of leading humans to God. And there are places where he even talks about like they sort of are more fully fulfilling even their natural telos if we sort of contemplate them in their nature and are led to God through them. So a frog is like more perfectly a frog if some biologists study it and are, you know, moved to sort of have this knowledge of God through them, or a mountain range is more perfectly a natural mountain range, even if, you know, through it we know God and are drawn to God through it. So it's sort of a complicated sort of how to work out the telos, and a student actually did a research project on this with me, and he drew sort of like an analogy between an instrumental causality, like a pen that has, you know, its own purpose as a pen, just to like make marks of ink on the paper. But you could talk about like maybe the pen that was used to write the Declaration of Independence or the Summa as being like a more perfect pen because it was sort of taken up and used then for this higher purpose, even though, you know, it also fulfills its ordinary purpose, just making marks on the page as well.
And is that distinction between the two teloses for the frog analogous to like the natural human telos versus the telos of being in union with God, or
that's a really interesting point. I don't know. I've never thought about that. I don't know what that. I mean, I haven't gone into all that stuff in Aquinas. There's a lot of controversy about how the natural and the supernatural relate in the scholarship. But that's a really striking thought, and that might be right and a good analogy to draw. Interesting.
Awesome. Thank you so much.